This is Dan Ray, the host of Nightside. I hope you enjoy listening to the Nightside podcasts here at the Nightside website, and I invite you to join us every Monday through Friday night from 8 to midnight for Nightside on WBZ News Radio 1030. With all due respect to my guest, this hour we could have done 2 hours, and we may get back later tonight to some of the issues dealing with the nomination, the Supreme Court nomination by President Obama last night, and of course the travel ban that seems to be quieting down a little bit, at least in the short term. So we'll talk about all of that a little bit later on. But we're going to shift focus, and we're going to talk about the other side of the world, China. With me in studio, Professor Greg Stoller, who is a senior lecturer at Boston University. And Professor Stoller has just returned from your 43rd trip.
Yes, I've been lucky enough to be taking students overseas 43 times in over 16 years.
43 times now, mostly to Asia, I'm assuming?
It depends. So I've been fortunate also to be teaching in France for 11 years. So 11 of those trips, I go there and the students come to me. The other 30 or so trips involved me taking either our graduate students or our undergraduate students, either consult, that's why we're in China 3 weeks ago, or to visit companies and government agencies. That's our upcoming March trip with undergraduate students from BU's Questrom School of Business.
And as everyone remembers, you've been on this show now several times. For a while, you were at Boston College for many years, but now you are moved up Commonwealth Avenue towards Boston University. So explain what this trip was all about. You're taking students. These are graduate students?
Correct. So the nice part about being able to do this at BU, and this was our first opportunity with the Questrom School of Business, is there's a concept at Boston University called One BU that no matter how large the university is, we're essentially all on the same team. So this trip, my client is a boutique strategy consulting firm based in Beijing. Think a smaller version of a Bain or a McKinsey or a Boston Consulting Group. We do work for their clients, who are all publicly traded or privately held Chinese firms. So this isn't McDonald's or Ford Motor doing business in China. These are your equivalent blue chip or privately held firms. We do consulting work for their clients. So this year we did renewable energy. We did brand valuation and advanced manufacturing. But the One BU concept is on my team. I not only had full-time and evening MBA students, I also had engineers, computer science students, and law students.
So how many students went over?
15.
How many?
15.
15.
Yeah, so we had 3 teams of 5.
Okay, and you were there how long?
We were there for a week.
For a week. So give me an example, because it's a concept that to me is a little alien, and I'm trying to understand. Someone's running a small company in China.
Right.
And they are receiving some consulting help from this Chinese company, this boutique company.
Correct.
That you're referring
right.
to. So you come in with your teams of in
right.
fact, consultants from America to help the boutique consulting company. What were the companies you were working with?
Sure. So as an example, we get the project specs every June. Brand valuation is a perfect example. They wanted to know, the consulting firm and its clients wanted to know how you value American brands, or in this case, also European brands. So we started the analytical work in June. We send them status updates in September and mid-October and mid-December.
I'm going to understand this better, so I'm going to interrupt you.
No, not at all.
Okay, why, if you're helping a Chinese small, not a Bain, but a Chinese
right.
consulting company, which I understand.
Right.
And you're helping them with their clients.
Correct.
Why do those clients in China need to know about the value of American brands?
Because they want to take that analytical approach and use it for their own brands in China. So if they're able to see how we would value a brand in the United States or a brand in France, and they can understand the analysis, the approach that goes into it, they can then replicate that and say, wow, we don't know what a Chinese brand might be worth. Because remember, Dan, through GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, we take it for granted that goodwill is built into the value of a company. We take it for granted that if you do a brand valuation survey and you say that Apple is the most powerful brand in the world, or blah, blah, or Coca-Cola is number two, or whatever the number is, that that's based on something. China isn't there yet in terms of an equivalent.
So they have no points of reference?
They have some points of reference, but you know, think about
not
it.
Not enough.
Not enough.
Okay, so
right.
let me do this. And again, I want to make sure I deal much better in the concrete than the abstract, as you have learned. Give me an example of one of the companies in China that your students were on the ground with helping in the last few weeks.
So there is a very successful metallurgy company that has been making metals. They used to be state-owned. They've now been privatized. They are trying to figure out if they can get financing for a new line of products that they are going to be rolling out. So they want to know how much their brand is worth.
So when you say metallurgy, making metals, I picture some factory where they're turning out steel or something.
Right, exactly. It isn't steel. I mean, this would be smaller. This would be iron. It wouldn't necessarily be steel. But in order to get financing from a Chinese bank, you need to determine how much your company's worth and how much brand equity is baked in.
So your team of BU students, right, graduate students, goes into this company, spends several days,
correct,
on the ground.
Well, they also spend 6 months in the States figuring out the engagement, doing analytical research. We send status updates in September, get the client's feedback. Send another status update in October, get more feedback.
So wait a second. Okay, again. Right. What's the status update?
So they say we want you to look at three different elements of brand valuation. And so our students go off, they interview people, they do some analytical work, and send the update to China.
Who do they interview here?
Other companies that, so for example, in this particular engagement, they interviewed some of the big brand valuation companies, the people who put together these surveys. They interviewed other executives who wanted to see how their brands were valued.
So wait a second. Your guys, your folks here, your guys, right, and gals here are going to companies in the Boston area or the New England area.
We're actually all over the country. Yeah,
all over the country. And the companies they're consulting with here,
right,
on behalf of the companies in China, they're trying to gather information about similarly sized and similarly situated companies here and assuming that the value of the company here might have some application for the companies, the small companies in China.
Right. And by the way, these aren't necessarily small companies. These could be publicly traded, mm-hmm, firms or huge behemoths.
I'm just trying to put in language that I understand.
You're absolutely okay. Correct. Right. The idea being that's one thing that, as smart as the Chinese are, and they're really smart, they don't necessarily at times have access to a network that is a strong network outside of China. They don't have the access to use social media as much as we do in the States. So our students add an incredible amount of value being able to chase down leads and come up with a framework and, you know, in terms of concrete, come up with ideas of how brand valuation in Europe is transferable to the United States, is transferable to China.
Now, I don't want to oversimplify this.
Right.
Okay. But let me just say that if, let us say, hypothetically,
right,
hypothetically, you had somebody in China who you thought could be a great baseball pitcher.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
And
love the sports reference.
Always sports references with me. And they were playing a little baseball in China, and he was striking everybody out. He said, this guy could be a pitcher in the major leagues. What you would have to do to figure out what his potential was, what his valuation,
right,
was to go over there and probably have someone look at him, have somebody put him on the radar,
right,
gun, and find out this guy's not throwing 93, he's throwing 59, and maybe that's good enough in China to strike people up,
right,
but it might not work back here. So that's kind of similar to what you're,
absolutely,
doing.
Absolutely, yeah. The idea being that you're...
Now I get it.
Thank you, that's great, that's great. I mean, the idea being that every year they change the topics based on what's in their pipeline, based on either new business they're trying to develop or existing engagements they want to expand.
Do they get this benefit from you guys for free?
Well, I mean, they obviously put something into it to make it worth our while, but yeah, it's been, you know, it's been a strong relationship for 16 years.
All right, we're going to talk about that. We've talked about that a little bit. We're also going to talk about what's going on in China. Now, you were there up until 2 weeks ago.
Correct.
So were you there on January 20th, or were you just...
We had just gotten home.
Gotten home. Okay, so we're going to try to talk about what you think the people in China are thinking towards us. There's a lot going on. China obviously has this military activity in the South China Sea, which we want to talk about. There's the concern over the phone call that President Trump accepted from the president of Taiwan. We have lots to talk about. Everything you want to learn about China, my guest can provide you with lots of information. Professor Greg Stoller, Stoller represents Boston University. He's been teaching at BC for many years. He is now at Boston University. You can tell the enthusiasm in his voice. He loves what he does.
Thank you.
He takes students. He teaches. He's a senior lecturer at Boston University, and we have him for the next hour. And you can ask any question you want because he's been to China now 30 times.
Oh, well, all of those trips haven't been to China, but I've been fortunate to be traveling back and forth to China since 1994 and Asia since 1991.
Right. So 30 trips to Asia, perhaps. And,
yes.
And a good percentage of them to China.
Yes. Yeah.
We'll be back. You know the number, 617-254-1030. 888-929-1030. Coming right back on Nightside.
And for a second, I thought I heard singing, sir.
Singing.
I listen to the Nightside people.
Nightside with Dan Ray.
I listen to the Nightside people.
WBZ News Radio 1030.
Okay, we're talking about China, talking about business in China. My guest in studio is Professor Greg Stoller. He teaches at Boston University, taught for 15 years at Boston College, business teacher, and he brings graduate students and has just come back from China. So let's talk about China. What I'm sure that in the midst of helping all these companies, there must have been some conversation about the election and the impending presidency, because you left just before
the inauguration.
Oh, absolutely.
As you were saying to Professor Hong, who was just on, I mean, you and I could talk about this on air for hours at a time. I mean, there's no shortage of material to talk about. And in preparation for tonight, I also separately interviewed 20 Chinese executives to get their opinion on Trump administration and the election.
So what do they think? What's the consensus?
I think I would divide into three, you know, interim conclusions. One is that it's still too early, in the sense that we assume that President Trump is just starting to understand his new role. China, of course, is trying to understand that role. But the Chinese are hoping, because Trump comes from a business background, that he's going to approach things in a transactional manner. And if that's the case, I think China is probably going to have an advantage, because they are the world's best negotiators. And if it's something that is over policy, it's difficult to sort of negotiate that away. But if you're talking about new trade deals or tariffs or currency adjustments or stuff of that ilk, if it's transactional, I think the Chinese are going to have an advantage. And third is, and I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible, they think that President Trump talks a little bit too freely at times.
Okay, well, I think a lot of people here might feel that way as well. One of the first dust-ups during the transition was him accepting the phone call from the president of Taiwan. Now, that didn't bother me as an American. Taiwan's, we have relations. We don't, I guess, have diplomatic relations. We have economic relations with Taiwan.
Correct, correct.
So there seemed to be, at least in our media here, a lot of outrage amongst the Chinese officials in the People's Republic.
Oh, absolutely.
Why? I mean, we know why.
Right.
But
I think that there are countries that place economics on the same level as politics. I think that China probably places nationalism on the same level as economics and politics. So China is less concerned solely about the economic impact and much about their nationalism, their one China policy, if you will. And they've sort of has taken it as a fait accompli that the United States, no matter who is in the Oval Office, is always going to respect the one China policy, bar none. And the fact that President Trump accepted a phone call and then a visit as she was passing through Texas is an interesting play for the moment.
So that seems to have receded a little bit. But there's an issue out there that a lot of people are concerned about, and that is that China is constructing these islands in the South China Sea, off the coast of China, in what would theoretically be international waterways.
So China is, and again, I go to great lengths to avoid introducing politics or religion in my classes. I'm not a political scientist, and I will leave that to professionals like you, Dan, and many of your other guests. But from what I'm able to glean, at least from a business standpoint, is China is wondering that if President Trump decides to have Japan pay for a portion of its self-defense, or other countries in the Pacific Rim changing the way that the cash flows are going to go, that is going to potentially free up monies and free up mind share to focus on other items. And along those other items, China wants to protect itself to make sure that it has a beachhead, literally as well as figuratively, geographically, geopolitically, and of course from a business standpoint.
So they are concerned that our policies vis-a-vis Japan might
cause problems for them?
Oh, absolutely.
Indirectly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I see. So that's okay. So, fair enough. Okay. Overall, at this point, is China looking forward to a new,
I think
set of
that
new relations?
China does not want to fight. I don't think they want to get into a tit-for-tat trade war or having to deal with tariffs or be accused of currency manipulation. But I think, based on the 20-odd interviews that I did in preparation for tonight, that they are very quietly doing preparations.
Okay, last, and I know this is politics is not the area, and I also am sensitive to the fact that you have to go back there, okay?
And by the way, you know, I'm very proud to be an American, but I've been lucky enough to be traveling over there for, 1994, so I think I have a unique perch.
Absolutely, and I understand that. So here's my question. What does China at this point think about North Korea? Now, for many, many years, China had a very special relationship with North Korea. Obviously, the Korean War involved China and the United States, 60-odd years ago. Are they at all concerned about what's going on vis-a-vis North Korea?
I've got a couple of ways to answer that question. First is, I think it's important to tell you and Nightside's listeners that the Chinese perception of time is a lot different than the U.S. perception of time. They would be more inclined to wait 5 to 7 years to see how something plays itself out, whereas in the States, we might wait 6 months or a year and try and affect some sort of change in the process. Vis-a-vis North Korea, I think the big concern is that if it tumbles, not very dissimilar to what happened in East and West Germany several years ago, that China is concerned that it's going to end up receiving the lion's share of refugees and all of the economic problems that go along with it.
If, on the other hand, North Korea does something crazy with vis-a-vis South Korea, and never mind the threats that they make against the United States, which I sort of think, well, it's not possible that they're going to fire a rocket to hit the United States, but
right.
Who knows? Do they have as much control, or I should say influence, with North Korea as they once did?
Again, under the cloak that this isn't my area of expertise,
yes, sure.
I think that over the past few years, they have, at least from a non-Chinese perspective, I think they've retreated a little bit. And I think they are certainly not shutting the door, but I don't necessarily think that they're going over there with open arms, with a bunch of Christmas gifts saying, we're back, let's party.
Well, Professor Greg Stoller, he could be a diplomat as well as a business business professor. We're going to go to phone calls right after the break. 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030. Your questions about China or particularly the economics of China. What is going on in China these days? And is economic freedom developing? It sounds to me like it is, and I am one who philosophically believes very deeply that economic freedom is inextricably intertwined with political freedom.
And I would agree with that.
Okay. And that, of course, is why the openings to China are so important. You know the phone numbers back on Nightside after this.
It's about time we had a little talk.
So let's talk.
Here comes the night.
The Nightside's on 10:30.
Nightside.
And all the people were calling, they went, na-na-na-na-na.
With Dan Ray, WBZ, News Radio 1030.
My guest, Professor Greg Stoller, and I have had Professor Stoller on the program on several occasions now. He's a very enthusiastic guest, which I appreciate, but I just learned talking to him, he speaks seven languages. Look, I have trouble with English. You said English, and you speak and understand Chinese?
I do, yes.
And Japanese?
Yep.
Arigato?
Do itashimashita.
I don't know. That means arigato
is
thank you, right?
Exactly,
yeah?
Right. Okay. You said thank you.
What else do you?
Chinese, Mandarin, Cantonese for Hong Kong, Korean, French, and a little bit of Spanish, and passable English.
Wow. Folks, all questions tonight and all comments, however, need to be in English. Let's start it off with Alex in Everett. Hey, Alex, welcome. You're first this hour with Professor Greg Stoller. Go right ahead.
Oh, hello, Professor. Quick question. What do you think of the entertainment industry between the United States and China, specifically movie making?
So that came up in my research for tonight as well. One of the most successful movie producers has basically sent a shot across the United States bow. This is Wong Jianlin, basically saying that if Trump drags the entertainment industry into a trade war, that all you know what is going to break loose. And he is very concerned. I think the consensus from all of the interviews that I did.
What would it all break loose?
Well, he does not want to see a trade war. And I think, as I was going to say, Alex, what people are most concerned about is they want to maintain the status quo. Is China had a good year in 2016, not a great year, but certainly a better year than 2015.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering, Professor, is if somebody wanted to get into the movie-making industry in, by way of the USA, into China and vice versa, what would be the best way to do it?
Oh, that's a much easier question. Is they are very much interested right now in doing cross-border stuff. In Davos, the same Wong Jianlin went over there. He's trying to hire a ton of people who are American to work in China, helping to improve their movie industry, and wants to get another foothold in Hollywood in order to have more Chinese investment and more Chinese actors and more Chinese producers be involved in the U.S. movie industry.
Anybody outside of Davos that you could recommend by way of China?
We could certainly talk offline, but yeah, there are certainly connections that are to be made.
Yeah, Alex, okay, I'll tell you what, Alex, you can contact Professor Stoller, I'm sure, at Boston University.
Yeah, no problem.
That's the easiest way. Just
My BU okay. email address of gstoller@bu.edu.
All right.
Excellent.
Hope
Thank
that
you.
Helps. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
All right. So he's looking to be in China. So we're talking about making American movies in China?
Correct. Or Chinese movies in the United States. So, for example, the hit movie that they are trying to get up and running right now is The Great Wall, starring Matt Damon. That's the latest sort of idea that they have that's coming. It's been billed as the first such Chinese-U.S. co-production blockbuster.
Okay, so the Great Wall we're talking about is not the Mexican Wall. We're talking about the original Great
different
Wall.
Different interview.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, and is that going to be an American company, Chinese company?
It's a co-production.
Co-production.
That's the exciting part about it, is that they figure that if they co-produce it and they co-invest in it, that good things are going to come for everybody.
And the storyline, I assume, would be about the building of the wall or something?
I think that part is being determined. That's not, you know, I'm not privy to those details,
okay,
but the idea being that it would be, you know, a historical look at why the Great Wall was built, and Matt Damon could do his thing, et cetera.
And Matt Damon would star in it in the American version.
Correct.
And then would they also have a Chinese version with subtitles?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And of course, the idea being, the idea being that this investor, Mr. Wong, he would love to purchase one of the big six Hollywood production houses. The problem is none of them is interested in selling right now, but he would love to.
There's still a lot of Chinese money coming into this country.
Oh,
right
that, yeah, that's
and we're
going to
talk
yeah.
about that in a moment,
yeah.
But let me keep going with the phone call. 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030. Then we go to Rich in Framingham. Rich, you are on with Professor Greg Stoller of Boston University. Go right ahead.
Hello, Dan. How are you doing? Great
Good.
Show. Thank you.
Thank you. Go right ahead. You're
Thank
on
you.
Professor Stoller.
Ask the professor, when he's over there with his students, is there a government official that he works with or that monitors them? Or
Great question, Rich. Yeah.
Check in with, so to speak, or sees his report?
Yeah. No, we have been very lucky over the years that we have built up trust in the sense that I'm sure we were probably monitored 15, 16 years ago. I wasn't aware of it. I've never been aware of it, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. But these days, we are very open with what we're doing. By the way, Dan, the question I thought you were going to ask me is when we do our research in the United States, we do all of that confidentially. We do not share any of the company names or the people we interviewed with our clients in China. And we try and add 150 footnotes. Each of the three projects we did this year, the students had at least 100 footnotes per project. So we try and be fully transparent so that nobody ever feels that we're doing something that is not kosher.
I see. Thank you. And one other question, if you could actually finish the sentence for me. It's in the best interest of the U.S. to help these Chinese companies get stronger because...
because I think that we coexist right now, economically as well as politically. I think if we work together, it can only help to promote both countries and both economies, as opposed to treating it as an us versus them scenario.
I see. Okay, fair enough. Dan, appreciate it. Thank you.
John, thanks very much. Have you ever been involved in anything over there? Or you,
no, I've never been to China.
All right. Thank you very much. Have
but
a great
night.
Thank
you, Dan. Thanks.
Thanks, Rich.
617-254-1030, 888-WBZ-1030. I think I just dropped one or two callers there inadvertently, Rob. So if they call back, put them at the head of the line. 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030. We have a new phone system here. It's really not all that new. It's about 6 months, but it's not really easy to function with, and every once in a while you hit a wrong button, and guess what? So we got a couple of open lines if you'd like to join the conversation about China. It's funny, I was watching a documentary on one of the I think it was ESPN. I was at the gym a couple of weeks ago, and there was a documentary on, I forget the name of the basketball player, but an American basketball player who was a big star here a few years ago, who's now a big star in the Chinese professional.
A American basketball player, Jeremy Lin?
No, Jeremy Lin, of course, was playing here.
Right, right.
Who went to Harvard and played here. And I'll think of it in a moment. But a big-time player whose NBA career ended.
Okay.
It was Stephen Marbury is who it was.
Okay.
Now that the name comes to me. And Marbury is now over there leading a team to the national championship, the equivalent of their NBA. Now, maybe our NBA is better, but their NBA. And I guess they have erected a statue to him in Peking, Beijing.
Right.
Beijing. And it's extraordinary the number of people from America who are now finding themselves over there. I was on a plane with a guy a couple of years ago, and he was going over there to become a chef. He was an American. He could go there and become a chef. There's job opportunities.
There are job opportunities, and I have to tell you, visa and paperwork notwithstanding, all you need to do is get on a plane. The stigma of I'm going across the Pacific or I'm going to the other side of the world is so much reduced these days. All you need to do is buy a ticket, get a visa, and you can go. And there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, let's face it, China's the world's second largest economy. I mean, not on a per capita basis, but on a GDP basis, they're the second largest economy. So as a result, there's ample opportunity.
We're going to continue our conversation with Professor Greg Stoller of Boston University. He has just returned from China, has been there many, many times with graduate students. They work in conjunction with Chinese businesses. The number of cities that he has been in is a long list. The cities you were working in this last trip?
This last trip was Beijing. Our undergraduate trip for BU's Questrom School of Business is for Hong Kong and Shanghai. I change the cities, the companies, and the countries every year. So we have 10 to 12 businesses lined up that we're going to in March.
Extraordinary. 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking with Kerry Severino. And we will be talking about the Supreme Court nomination. So if you want to get in and talk about China, our relationship with that company, where it's been, where it's going, there's no one in the world that I know who is more competent to explain to us than Professor Gregory Stoller. Back on Nightside right after this.
We have so much to talk about.
So we can't speak openly.
I think we should.
You talk. I'll listen.
Always listen to Nightside at night.
Nightside with Dan Ray.
Always listen to Nightside at night.
WBZ News Radio 1030.
My guest is Professor Greg Stoller. He teaches at Boston University and has, I think, a very interesting professorship because he takes graduate students around the world. Is it two or three times a year?
So I take undergraduates one time a year and graduate students one time a year as well.
So two trips, which last about 2 weeks, if memory serves?
It depends. Every year it depends on budgets and whatnot. This year we're doing Hong Kong and Shanghai in a week for the undergrads. Last year we did Hong Kong and Beijing. Usually the consulting trip is in Beijing. But next year I might do Tokyo and Seoul or Tokyo and Bangkok.
How tough is it for these students? Because I would think that if I was an undergrad or a graduate student at BU, I'd want to get into one of your classes.
Most of the classes are by application. Not an onerous application, but, you know, one-page letter, one-page cover letter, a one-page resume, one-page cover letter. And we want to make sure that people are really going to get something out of it from a business standpoint. I take great pride in the 20-plus years that I've been doing this, that every year we've been able to place somebody in some sort of job as a result of one of these experiences. And I'm not going to be arrogant and say it was from my class, but it just adds an interesting background to the resume. It's a discussion starter, if you will. And I'm just so excited that whether from the grad side or the undergrad side, that we're helping our students get jobs.
Now, do the students have to pay for the transportation and
accommodations? It depends on the trip. But this last trip to Beijing, all of the money that they paid covered 80% of their meals, hotel, airfare, lodging, meals, etc., sightseeing. Undergraduate trip is similar. I work very hard with the folks at BU and with our travel agents to make this as affordable as we can for people.
But again, this is by taking the course. If you're accepted the course, you don't get the trip. You still have to pay for.
All right. There's an out-of-pocket expense, but the way I look at it is that if you're serious about international business in Asia or otherwise, it is, you know, for pick a number, $3,000. It's an investment if you amortize that over, say, 10 years. In your future career.
Absolutely. One of my listeners, Sylvia, writes, Dan, there's still censorship by the government in Chinese movies, I believe. They don't want anything to make China look bad, I've read. Is she right?
She is. China believes strongly that the one-party system is going to work, that the one-party system is going to be more successful or equally successful than the democratic system. And something that you get with the one-party system is the ability to censor. And let's face it, when you go over there, there is no Facebook. Depending on the relations, you might not get access to the New York Times or Google. But I think as long as you know about it before you go over, it's not a surprise. But the same way there are certain countries in the world that the power is going to go off once a day. You just have to deal with it.
Were you able to get over there the internet, or is it?
Of course. I mean, it's China. It's not, you know, some backwater location that doesn't have hot and cold running water. It doesn't have working.
Is China able to monitor what you can see on the internet in China?
I'm sure they are, but I also think the United States monitors what we do on the internet.
Okay, but for a while wasn't China trying to shut down?
Well, they've shut down, if you will, social media platforms that they're not able to censor as quickly. So Facebook, YouTube, Google, these are all platforms that it's very difficult to sort of put a dome around and say, we want to control the censorship. But again, knowing the country as I do and respecting the country as I do, I'm not going to say you work around it. That sounds like you're doing something unethical, but you factor your plans into that you're not going to get access to the sites you're used to.
So you could get CNN or you could get Fox.
Right, exactly. Okay. It's a perfect analogy.
Okay.
The radio's all yours now.
Yeah! You talk a lot.
Just making conversation.
We're talking, talking, talking. Conversation's knocking. Intelligence is rocking. Nightside.
Nightside with Dan Ray, WBZ, News Radio 1030.
We're talking about China. There's no way to underestimate the importance of China in the world. There are, 7 billion people in the world, and China has 1.2 billion of them.
Correct.
And they have cities that are modern cities. Their infrastructure, very good. Airports, I'm told, very good. A lot of problems with pollution.
Yes. Okay. This was the first time we were over there that the pollution was pretty challenging. I mean, the first time ever since 1994.
Okay, we're going to talk more about that in a moment, but let me get Bob. I want to get as many callers in as we can. Bob is in Boston. Hey, Bob, welcome. You are next with Professor Greg Stoller of Boston University. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking my call. And I'm late to the conversation. Maybe you've already talked about it, but I'm just wondering how our new president's how he's going to affect our relations with China. Is it going to make it harder to do business there? There are some military ramifications to that and so forth. Any thoughts?
Sure. Great question, Bob. China is currently taking a wait-and-see attitude. I think everyone's taking a wait-and-see attitude. What I said earlier in the hour is I interviewed 20 executives in preparation for tonight. What they've told me is that if we do A and A is very difficult on China, then they will respond in kind and do B. If we do C, they'll do D. And if nothing happens, it will be business as usual. I think as Dan was saying earlier, right now things are going pretty well on both sides of the Pacific. So I don't think anybody wants to rock the boat. But who knows? It could be nothing is going to happen over the next 4 years, or something dramatic could happen next week.
Yeah, how important was it what Trump talked directly to the president of Taiwan? Didn't he do something like that?
Yes. So Trump decided that he would have a dialogue. There was something called a One China policy, where they want the United States to only view China as being the single sovereign nation, as opposed to what's happening. They're permitting Hong Kong's the one country, two systems. Taiwan, in China's opinion, is the renegade province. From the United States' opinion, they are perspective. They're a very important partner of ours, unofficially, and as Dan pointed out, non-diplomatically. And I think people are starting to figure out if that's going to change or stay the same. But it is very much a political football right now.
Right. Okay, well, look, thanks. I'm enjoying the conversation. Thank you, Bob.
Appreciate your call.
Thanks for the feedback.
You mentioned Hong Kong. There were a couple of years ago, there was a lot of unrest in Hong Kong. I remember when Hong Kong first was, and I don't know what verb I should use, reabsorbed by China. Hong Kong elected a couple of separatists back then. What was that 3-4 years ago?
No, this actually happened 6 months ago, is that two Hong Kong politicians, when they were taking the oath of office, made disparaging comments about China. And the Chinese government, out of nowhere, swooped in and basically prohibited them from taking the oath and accepting office, and just basically kicked them out. And they appealed to the court in Hong Kong, and they lost.
So for many years, Hong Kong had been a British protectorate.
Correct.
Okay. Although it is an island off the south of Hong Kong, China. Taiwan, of course, is an island off its east coast.
Right.
Small island, but a significant population.
Correct. The story with Hong Kong is that they had a 99-year lease from the UK. And that lease, I believe, expired in
1999.
Exactly. And ever since then, it's been one country, two systems, that China was going to, mainland China was going to participate and permit Hong Kong to do what it's doing, because you don't want to necessarily affect the chicken who's laying the golden eggs, or the goose who's laying the golden eggs. But this incident, if you will, with the two separatists.
They asserted their authority.
Right. They basically asserted their authority, and they've been doing that ever so often when things come up on their radar that they don't like. And once again, you know, I can buy your house, and you might have had your kids grow up in that house, and you might love the color blue. But if I bought your house and I want to change it to green or yellow or pink, you might not like it. But the fact of the matter is, I own your house. And so, good, bad, or ugly, Hong Kong reverted to Chinese rule, and China is now feeling its way through the process in terms of how it's going to deal with universal suffrage and politics and, of course, economics.
So do residents of Hong Kong, they're now Chinese citizens.
Correct.
Okay.
But they still have Hong Kong passports.
Okay. So it's sort of a hybrid set of circumstances.
Correct. Correct.
Do they participate in elections, to whatever extent China has elections?
So that is, you were very kind enough several years ago to have me on here on your show when we were talking about the Umbrella Revolution, and there was a journalist from Boston Magazine who wrote articles, and we had a nice talk about it on the air for an hour. The latest challenge is that China is saying to the residents of Hong Kong, you can vote for whomever you would like, provided we approve the slate of people in advance. And the people from Hong Kong are saying, that's not how the process works. We want to be able to nominate whoever we want to nominate, regardless of whether you've vetted or approved them.
And this would even be local officials, meaning the mayor of Hong Kong.
That I can't answer. I don't know it to that level of detail, but all I can tell you is that raised the hackles of people in Hong Kong.
I'm assuming that Hong Kong would have some sort of representatives in whatever legislative system China has in Beijing.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
And then one other question, and this is one that I know you probably know the answer to, and I don't know. I've heard 1.2 billion residents.
Yes.
But in the western provinces, and matter of fact, Trump talked about how all the airports in China are far better than the American airports. They've invested a lot in infrastructure, that type of infrastructure. Yet in the western provinces of China, my understanding is there are still people who live out there and literally live in caves.
Absolutely. So I think that there's a misnomer that all 1.2 billion people are not necessarily living in Hong Kong, in Beijing, in Shanghai, and Nanjing, etc., that the the Midwest and the western part of the country, Xinjiang, as an example, still has a ways to go economically.
And we are, what, nearly 70 years into the revolution, 1949. Has the revolution not hit that part of the world,
well,
that part of the country?
Well, I think that things change a lot. Obviously, you and I could talk about this for hours, but the gist of it is that people used to migrate from the hinterlands in order to seek employment.
City.
Right. Now, of course, they're moving the factories back to the hinterlands. So as a result, all of the migratory trends have changed. And as a result, that's causing cities in the Midwest, tier two, tier three cities that formerly were pretty much ignored, now they've become serious economic metropolises because of the labor force that they have there. And they don't have to leave, so they can stay there with their families and still earn a very nice wage.
Okay. And then my final question, and I always want to touch upon this, religious freedom. It is actually expanding, as I understand that David Seidler, our
Night Side Ambassador to China, right?
Yes, right.
Right. I would say that everything in China from across the board, whether it be politics, economics, religion, is changing. I would argue it's changing for the better. It's not ever going to go at the pace that we are used to in the West because it's not a Western country. They're doing things at their own pace. And remember, they've got over 4,000 years of recorded history. As proud as I am to be an American, we're not even close to that by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, they certainly beat us in duration in terms of where I would want to live, and I suspect in terms of where you would want to live, we are still a great place to visit, but there's no place like home.
Absolutely. But I would say that's true of going to New York or going to Canada or
going to
Paris, right. But it's a heck of a great place to go, and I'm very fortunate to be able to go multiple times a year and extremely fortunate that all of the coursework I was doing at Boston College has come over to Boston University, and it's just I'm very, very happy and appreciative.
And if folks want to contact you at Boston University, how do they do that?
Yes, they can use my BU email address, which is gstoller@bu.edu. That's gstoller@bu.edu. Or you could check out my blog, languageofbusiness.biz. That's languageofbusiness.biz. We're doing a weekly television show that's up on that blog and other media materials as well, op-eds or whatnot. I genuinely would love to hear from Nightside listeners or viewers of the TV show. I'd love to continue the dialogue well after our hour ends.
Our hour has ended. As always, it's been great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the opportunity, Dan.
Thank you very much. We're coming back. We're going to be talking a little bit more politics and Supreme Court nominations right after Dawn of the Tech.